This week, U.S. equities rallied sharply, along with the XAU Golden Silver Shares Index. Your host, Chris Walczyk, with another big show. We have two must-hear interviews this week. First at bat, Dr. Martinson, in spring training form from peakprosperity.com. He's watching the crude oil market. He sees signs of a double bottom, but he's most excited by the prospects of the yellow metal, which is higher by nearly 20% for the year. He thinks that gold is going to benefit most from this major paper money zenith that we've been hearing about for 20 years in the gold crowd. And he agrees with me that U.S. equities could be facing the first big bear market in about 7 years. Then the silver investor, David Morgan, returns to the show. We discuss the best annual start to the precious metals market in decades. He'd like to see this short covering rally continue for another month or two as the retail investment crowd starts to regain confidence in what he's terming a new bull market for the precious metals. And we also discussed an interesting trend, let's call it a contrarian play, where central bankers tend to sell most or the bulk of their stockpile of gold near key market bottoms. Well, around the year 2000-2002, the Bank of England had this dubious honor of selling off the bulk of its gold at around $250-$270 an ounce. Fast forward 12 years later from that date, and we're seeing $1,900 gold. Guess what? The Bank of Canada and a few others have divested most, if not all, of their gold from the national reserves at what might be at or near the latest correction bottom. So just another key point here for our gold aficionados. And Robert Ian joins the show with another must-hear report, wrapping it all up at the end of this one-hour episode. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies were seen over the precious metals this week, as some investors chose the sidelines ahead of next week's FOMC meeting, as well as other major policy decisions around the globe. By Friday's close, the yellow metal was off just $9 for the week, less than a percentage point, finishing at $12.51 an ounce. That's solid. Silver finished at $15.51, near the break-even point, with its eyes set firmly on 20 to 21. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index finished at 68, actually up a point, bucking the trend, while West Texas Intermediate crude added another $2, 6%, finishing at $38.50 a barrel. That has to be at least a $13 rally from the $26 lows. Might I mention about a 50% return in 1 month's time? Congratulations to all of my Alpha Stocks newsletter subscribers who purchased our candidate, the Leveraged Oil ETF, 4 weeks ago. This amazing rally has now returned 50% on that at least, and another 100% on the calls or more. So congratulations. Meanwhile, on next Wednesday afternoon, Fed policymakers will announce a rate decision. The current Fed funds futures contract indicates 96% odds of no change. So the current benchmark overnight lending rate will hold pat at 50%. Gold is higher by 20% for the year so far, registering the best quarterly performance in 2 years and the best annual beginning in decades. Holdings in exchange traded funds have increased 18%. This year. That's the fastest pace in 6 years. In fact, gold stockpiles and ETFs rose for the 18th straight trading day. That's also the best in about 6 years, adding 1.3 metric tons to the 17-ton total, according to a Bloomberg report. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, this was an important week, I think, for the metals. Despite the explosive moves in gold and silver and the XAU shares, already this year, from a technical vantage point, there appears to be solid upside potential ahead, in particular for silver, which I think is poised to run to 20 to 21.80 or so. This also happens to coincide with the first peak to trough Fibonacci retracement level for my more technically inclined folks that started at our peak at around $50 in the year 2011 down to our recent $1,350 correction lows. However, I really can't advocate speculation here because these types of bottoms tend to back and fill for months and sometimes many years. I'm just a big believer of increasing gold and silver shares as the bullion, increasing the portfolio exposure here, I think is very much advisable. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, nary a cloud was seen over the New York Stock Exchange for the fourth week running. Investors added shares amid lower Fed fund rate hike odds. Investors were particularly pleased with the EU minister's decision, dovish monetary decision this week. The Dow finished at 17,213, up 206 for the week, about 1.2%, and the S&P 500 ended at 20,022, up 22 points, 1.1%, while the NASDAQ added 31, about 0.67%, finishing at 47,48 for the week. Well, meanwhile, investors appreciate the inflationary policies adopted by the Bank of Japan, which enacted negative rates this year, along with Denmark, the Eurozone, Sweden, and Switzerland. Currently, $8 trillion of sovereign debt has the enticing offer to investors of less than zero interest. In other words, we'll take your funds from you, and we'll charge you for the privilege. The ECB loosened monetary policy last Thursday, while the Bank of Japan and the Bank of England, as well as the Fed, all meet next week. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, market volatility is viewed by the CBOT, VIX, and VVIX. Somewhat mixed here. It looks cautiously bullish. However, the fear and greed index has swung into the extremely greedy category. There's no reason to be chasing shares. One last note, for the first time in 7 years, a key long-term moving average, the 50 period, has rolled over into the negative on all three of our major U.S. index on the weekly charts. And this, I think, indicates the potential for a major sea change here that might come to pass either this year or within the next year or two, and more than likely it could result with a bear market. For the time being, I just don't see any reason, other than for the most fleet-footed, flash-like investor, to chase shares. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned, with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
You're back with GoldSeek Radio. Today's special guest, David Morgan. Joining me with his take on the precious metals sector, the silver investor, David Morgan, pens the Morgan Report, runs silver-investor.com. Welcome back, David Morgan.
Thank you so much.
Start off the discussion today with your take on this remarkable year for the precious metals. Silver market, gold market up sharply double digits, as well as the XEU HUI shares indices. A lot of positive news, and certainly looks as though the shorts are uncomfortable here.
Well, just to reiterate what you said, Chris, the best market starts in 35 years, according to Anonymous Magazine. It's the largest inflows into the gold ETF since 2009. Obviously moved up substantially from the beginning of the year, and that's the leading asset class. I do think, as you suggest, been a lot of short covering, and I think there's more to come. I think that there's probably another month or month and a half that we could see gold go even higher. I think silver is not confirming the gold move. I would like silver above 16 as we're witnessing today's price in the gold market. We're doing this in early March 2016. Nonetheless, I think they'll both continue upward. And the retail investors are still on the sideline, which means that we have more room to the upside, I think, because most of the people that have been, you know, burned or sat out or watched this market are still holding on, or however you want to phrase it. There's all those categories, people that have given up that will come back in, held on for 4 or 5 years, witnessing lower and lower prices that are now, you know, turning upward, and they will come back into the market. And I think that is going to be the near-term peak, which means we'll probably see, I'm going to use the example of a price, not an exact price, the idea is important. But if we get to, say, $1,300 gold, and all of a sudden the retail market picks up substantially, where my friends that are on the retail side let me know that this is like the best month they've had in 9 months, or the best month they've had in, like, you know, in a year and a half, or that type of thing on a volume basis, then I would be remiss to not state on your show that this would be a time where you would probably see the market pull back, and I was like to say on the commodity side, back and fill. So I'm waiting for that kind of that last hurrah, if you want to call it that, where the retail market starts to liven up, heat up, speed up, and then that leads to a disappointment on a short-term basis. And then once we back and fill and rebuild, then I'd like to see silver confirm the next move up. And at that point, I think we're going to see, you know, the bull market continue, which I believe the bull market has started, but nonetheless, maybe in a more measured way for this year. I really don't think this year's going to be like a tremendously huge upward trend for the metals, although it could be. I mean, I always have to give the caveat. I don't, it's required. There's too many black swans out there to say, you know, this couldn't be the year that everything just takes off, because it could. But barring that event or events taking place, we certainly could. I mean, just look at the Middle East situation. Regarding, you know, things being normal, whatever that means, we would continue to be kind of in a grinding up situation. But I really think that the longer term, 2 to 5 years out, that this market, the precious metals market, and those associated with it, meaning the ETFs, the mining stocks, be them, you know, extreme speculation, speculative, mid-tier, top-tier, regardless, are going to have probably one of the largest moves in the financial record books. I know that sounds extreme, and the reason it's extreme is because we're in extreme conditions. We've never had the debt problem on a global basis we have now. So the counterbalance to the global debt crisis, the currency wars that are ongoing, is something that's trusted throughout eons, and that's gold and silver. So that's the counterbalance. So as one swings one way, the other one swings the other way. It's the teeter-totter. And so I think with the debt destruction that I see ahead, you're going to see, again, record-setting events taking place in the precious metals.
We've seen this in several indexes over the last just 20 years. You might recall the internet bubble led to a 3 or 4 year cataclysm for U.S. equities, and then that took a year or so of building a base. We saw it again in 2008, 2009. It built a base for those markets in the housing market as well. You know, around 2012, built a base and then rallied for several years. Just because we have maybe seen the bottom in the precious metals does not mean that it will be a mad dash to the former highs. That takes time. Do you agree with that?
I do. And you also have to look at it from, you know, the big, big picture, which means you've got that in terms of the currencies. I mean, if you're looking at gold in terms of, you know, the Canadian dollar or the Aussie dollar, I mean, gold looks pretty darn strong and isn't that far off the highs. So, you know, it depends which lens you're focusing through. I mean, if you focus through the U.S. dollar metric, then, of course, gold's, you know, coming off the bottom, it's looking stronger and all that. So there's lots of ways to look at the market, but you really have to look at the whole market. I mean, to digress in an important point, what I've said for years, and don't say often on radio shows, is that the currencies are what I call the banker's last vestige of hope, which means that bankers have got this game called monopoly. And a monopoly is not only in the banking system itself, but what stripe of piece of paper you have, because these value against each other. But they're all pieces of paper. And you get the arguments, oh, it's a resource-backed economy, and all that's pretty much nonsense. The bottom line truth is that they're all paper currencies printed at the will of the government to inflate their way out of a problem. And QE1, QE2, QE3, QE4, Operation Twist, all this stuff is just a paper chase to try to solve a debt problem with more debt. Doesn't work. We all know that. But that doesn't matter. The ECB decides, well, that's a great thing to do. Let's do the same thing. Let's print more to print our way out of this mess because we've printed too much already. But that's not working. So what we do is, well, if zero interest rate policy doesn't work, let's go to negative interest rate policies. That'll work. That's sure. That's going to help the situation. So we are in dire straits. Regardless of how you view the currency markets, it's a very good way for 99% of the world's population to say, oh, safety is to have cash. And they all think that, you know, maybe the U.S. dollar is the best cash to hold. Relative to these other different colored pieces of paper of different sizes on a global basis, maybe it looks that way and could be that way for a while. But when the bottom line hits, when the final tally is taken, that's when you have to look at what you really have. You know, I listened to an interview of a well-known gold person that's very astute, and he has a different view on the banker's view of gold than mine. He basically said, you know, it's a small market, and bankers really don't care that much about gold. And the interviewer said, well, you know, they're accumulating gold like crazy. He goes, well, that's true of Russia and China, but not so much these other, you know, banks. And, you know, he basically made the point from his perspective that gold really isn't all that important to the banking powers. I disagree. I think that the public image for the banking powers is that gold isn't very important. I think that's pretty easy to prove. What isn't so obvious is if you dig deeper. And if you dig deeper and go to the BIS, which is the Bank of International Settlements, which is referred to as the banker's banks, back over a decade ago now, Chris, they only accounted for the asset base of all members of the BIS in one term and one term only. That was gold. G-O-L-D, gold. Remember, gold is money and everything else is credit, J.P. Morgan. But Jamie Dimon seemed to have forgotten that phrase. The point I'm making is very simple. The banker's bank accounted for what each bank's worth was based on what their gold holdings were. Now, they're not going to tell you that anymore. You have to do some pretty deep research to find it, even if it exists anymore, if you could pull off the net or not. I don't really know. What I do know is that we are in the times of trouble, the telling of untruths, the disinformation campaigns that are there in a way to just keep the status quo going, keep the paper chase, the dominant thinking for everyone, except the rare few that can think for themselves or critically think. Does this mean gold solves all problems? Of course not. But what it does mean is on the financial basis is probably one of the best places to be.
Well, in these times of trouble, you might hearken back to, I guess it was the year 2000, 2001, when the Bank of England divested most, if not all, of its gold at near the lows of the around $250, $260 per ounce. It was reported, and, you know, that really marked a sea change in the bear market. It really marked the nadir and the inception of a new bull market that ran 12 years unbroken, one of the greatest bull markets, I think you'd agree, in financial market history. We've seen a similar thing occur with the Bank of Canada, essentially divested most, if not all, of its gold stockpile. Do you take that as a contrarian sign, just like the Bank of England?
Absolutely. In fact, Chris, as you know, I just got back from the PDAC, the Prospector and Developers Association of Canada, the largest mining show. And it's one of the most important ones because this is where a lot of networking and deals get done. But regardless of that, the talk occasionally was about that very fact. Again, going back to the BIS on a gold-only basis. So basically what we're saying is that, you know, divest yourself on a nation-state basis of the one asset that's worked for, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years. Get rid of that, and let's stay in this paper chase with this experiment that's been tried time and time and time again and has a 100% failure rate. Yeah, that's what we'll stick with. So, you know, again, I mean, I am certainly far from having all the answers, but certainly I know what the past is prologue for the future, and it's a pretty bleak future if you look at what's happened in the past. And if you take into account that this is now a global situation and the flows are going from west to east, you know, Canada and England have gotten rid of their gold. Where the U.S. stands on that, we know what they say, you know, on a piece of paper. The physical certainly moved into, you know, Russia and China primarily. Interesting times. You know, the worst case scenario really isn't as bad, I don't think, as most may. I mean, certainly no one knows the future, yours truly included. But normally in a financial crisis, the wealth stays in place, but it gets reevaluated. It's sort of like cleaning out your garage you haven't looked at in 10 years. You know, that day finally comes where you have to do it. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's there that's absolutely worthless that you throw away. There's other stuff that needs to be repaired. You set to the side and you decide to give it away or repair it. And then there's the useful stuff that you need to keep. And that's sort of a really corny analogy for what will take place in the financial markets. There's a lot of debt that just has to be wiped off the books one way or the other. There's a lot of things that are maybe marginal that with proper management could come back and be useful to the physical economy. And then there's stuff that is vital to the physical economy that maybe could be better managed or is fine the way it is. And then things reset and go on. Now, that's easier to say philosophically, as I just outlined, than the actual pain and agony that could take place in some sectors, because if you're on the wrong side or you're one of those things that needs to be thrown away, it's going to hurt. You don't want to be thrown away. But this is what is necessary, and this is what will take place. The chances of it taking place through the political structure is almost nil, regardless of who gets into the office or what happens or what they say or what the rhetoric is. The market at this point is going to be in charge of that. And when the market speaks, there isn't too many people that can fight it. Yes, I know the markets are manipulated. Yes, it's obvious. I mean, there's been fines. It's been proven that, you know, the LIBOR scandal and, you know, all this stuff has taken place in the markets. All your listeners are probably aware of most of it. But that doesn't change the fact that the big reset hasn't taken place by the markets itself. It darn near happened in 2008. In fact, had it been let go, and the pain and agony that would have taken place would have been substantive and substantial and certainly not only painful, which isn't probably a strong enough word, but it probably would have cleaned the slate for us to move back up, us globally, us the world economy, us the physical economy on a global basis. But it wasn't allowed to happen. Instead, it was extend and pretend, as James Sinclair says. So we pretended that everything would be okay. All we had to do is add a bunch of paper to the system and things would get better, and they haven't. So the day of reckoning is ahead. What will take place is basically what I outlined, and what exact sectors, et cetera. I mean, I'll leave that to the listeners to determine. What we do know from history is that gold and silver are, you know, kind of the last man standing. And basically, when you look at it, it's just basically the best savings that you can have. I mean, if you're a true capitalist or look at it from the Austrian perspective that I do, I mean, wealth is really the means of production. I mean, wealth isn't holding a bunch of gold coins. That is a way to store wealth. But, you know, when the reset takes place and you're coming out the other side, I mean, if you have a head and a heart, you want to look for what fundamental business that you could start that would be prosperous to yourself and others at large. I mean, that paradox of serving yourself and serving others at the same time. That's what you should be thinking through as far as I'm not the soapbox probably, but thanks for having the interview. I really appreciate it. And I'm really kind of pumped up after the PDAC. It looks to me from the size of it, was the smallest one I've seen in probably 15 years, which again is a strong indicator that the bottom is probably behind us.
You might recall that the late Hugo Chavez was responsible for repatriating much, if not all, of the original Venezuelan stockpile. Since his passing, they have virtually sold off the bulk. Since they tend to make the wrong moves in the bigger picture, I think that, you know, individual investors can learn much from their mistakes.
No, I agree. I mean, it again goes back to, you know, our earlier comments. I mean, if these banks don't care about gold, then why do they care about gold? I mean, it's pretty much, you know, it's the watch what they do, not what they say. So if this is what they're doing, then just, you know, use some critical thinking. Why? Why would they want gold? If gold's so unimportant or means so little, then why are they making that so important? And why was it so difficult for Mr. Chavez to bring the gold back? I mean, it wasn't really an easy thing, and they paraded it through the main streets of the city to, you know, show everyone, here it is, you know, take a look. This is our national treasure. And, of course, now it's being given up to, you know, basically eat. I mean, you know, gold is gold. I mean, I have a philosophical tie to gold and silver, but it's philosophical. I mean, the idea could be that, you know, are you going to give up a gold coin to eat? Of course you are. So on a macro scale, are you going to give up a gold coin to eat? And the answer is, of course you would, from, you know, Venezuela's point of view, from a country's perspective.
I'd like to move on to, you know, this bifurcation that we see between paper and physical. Now, this topic has obviously had a lot of play over the last 15, 16 years. And we've seen U.S. stocks move back to their year 2000 peak, and in many cases, considerably higher. S&P 500, Dow Jones, well above their peaks of 15, 16 years ago. The implications on a forward basis, this is cyclical. And eventually, that money is going to be scared, because it's over-leveraged and everybody is convinced that stocks are the place to be. And that money gets scared and we start to see a lot of bids come in to gold and silver. Can you find a scenario where something similar to the year 2000 through 2003, not 2008, but 2003 come to pass, and just what that might mean for the precious metals sector?
Well, I can. I think you've really outlined it. I think that's kind of where we are right now. I think if you go to that part of where, you know, there was a, what I call the stealth phase of the bull market and the precious metals, we're not in the stealth phase, but we're in a phase where a lot of people have been washed out, don't want to participate anymore. And because of that fact, they are, you're going to have to rebuild the base, as you said, and then we will start in. And this is the third leg up, or the fifth wave of an Elliott wave cycle, if you are an Elliott person, which I'm really not, but that's the theory. And this is the one that is the longest in price appreciation, but not necessarily the longest in time duration. So as I've often said, 90% of the move comes in the last 10% of the time. And this is what I think we're looking forward to over the next few years. Now, that doesn't mean, as we said, that it would be right away. We're going to have to, you know, grind forward. But once we grind up to the 1550 level in gold and the $26 level in silver, and they both confirm each other, I think we've got an absolute that we're into the next leg up and the biggest leg up in the precious metals.
You know, $50, $100 gold. I mean, sure, we can speculate all day if the gold to silver ratio were to return to anything near its traditional pace or the geological ratio relative to gold right now. But keeping things just kind of level-headed, taking this one leg up at a time, shouldn't we really be focusing on a 50% retracement of the bear market, if you want to call it that, or major correction of the last 4 or 5 years? And then once we have eclipsed that number, we start to talk about revisiting, you know, returning to maybe the former highs, 50 and around 1900 on gold. And then once we've reached those nominal levels, we can start to look forward to maybe the inflation adjusted value for gold and silver.
Yes, I agree. And I just add slightly that I was asked by a major, one of the largest gold holdings undeveloped in the world at the PAC. He and I had a very nice talk, and he asked me that, and he respected me, and he thinks I'm not, you know, over the top. He says, what do you think about $5,000 gold? And I said, look, I think it could happen. And then we outlined what you just said. And yeah, at the peak panic buying phase, which lasts for a very short duration, look at what happened in 1979 to 1980. You'll get a good idea of what could take place this next time.
But how much of that was the result of the Hunt brothers and a few major speculators cornering the market? An anomaly? Or would it have happened even if those big players, Jesse Livermore types, weren't around in the markets?
Well, it had some effect, but not nearly as much as most people think. If you look at Paul Sarnoff's book, Silver Bulls, and you see when the Hunts got in and when they stopped buying and what the market did from that point upward, yeah, they had an influence, but not as much as they're attributed. It's like they caused the whole thing. It's not true. This time, if the Hunt brothers and Sakes caused that, then think of what would it be if a couple of large hedge funds and the global population of the Chinese alone wanted to buy into the metals. Think of it in terms of that was a U.S. phenomena in 1980 versus a global phenomena in 2018.
While we wrap up here, I wonder if you could tell folks what you're expecting for the remainder of 2016. A lot of interesting political changes, changing almost every week. So, I mean, that's certainly a big wild card. And the potential for much lower or even negative rates here in the United States. Very positive factors. Even the CRB, the commodities index, starting apparently to turn the corner, and West Texas Intermediate crude appears to have put in at least a temporary floor. Would you like to bring it all together and give folks your overview for 2016, please?
I think the metals will lead. It'll back and fill. I think we'll have a positive year for the precious metals, but not like an outstanding record-setting year. I think that oil going to oscillate back and forth, but I think higher overall, and if barring some event in the Middle East, which could send oil to 50, 60 bucks really quickly. And I think that the body sector at large isn't going to recover substantially, even though the CRB index, as you mentioned, is looking more positive. I look more for the precious metals to lead and oil to fit in back and forth. But the one looking out a year or more is the ax, the agricultural markets. This food crisis that's in our future is going to come to the fore at some point.
So I guess what you're really waiting for is for the global economic situation to improve, to see China, the United States, and Europe, Japan. And then, of course, that increases demand for underlying commodities.
I'd like to do a little promo here for our new, I've rebranded to the Morgan Report. So anyone interested in our work can go to themorganreport.com. Just finished a update report called Riches and Resources. For free, it is about 7 pages long. Lots of good information for everybody. You can go to themorganreport.com. Give us a first name and an email address. We'll send you that report for free. I'll leave it to that.
Very good. David Morgan, we will definitely have those links up on GoldSeek, GoldSeek Radio, on the newsletter so they can access it there. David Morgan.
Thank you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes 3 deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Today's featured guest, Dr. Chris Martinson from Peak Prosperity. Dr. Chris Martinson, economic researcher, futurist, and wears many other interesting hats at peakprosperity.com, along with Adam Taggart, who see big trouble ahead for the domestic economy. Welcome back, Dr. Chris Martinson. Hello, sir.
Why, hello. It's good to be back with you.
Well, it's just great to have you back with us. I know one of your favorite topics, oil, you know, crude oil, West Texas Intermediate. We're starting to see some signs of a floor in the commodities and the CRB index, the precious metals. At one point, gold up about 15-16% for the year. Its best start in decades. Why don't we start off today with black gold?
Well, absolutely. From a price perspective, it certainly looks like it double bottomed once about in the middle of January, the second in the middle of February. Up pretty handily off of those two bottoms. I'm not convinced that we're at the full bottom yet, though, and this is really more of a fundamental story, and I know we're in a market that's largely driven by speculators and a lot of hot money really moving things around, but at the end of the day, oil is one of those commodities, unlike gold, where there's limited storage space above ground, and the United States seems to be brimming. It's a little bit confusing because not only is the United States brimming, but we're still importing. We increased our imports over the last few months as well. So it seems odd to be importing more while you don't really have good places to put it. So from that perspective, just looking at how it's piling up, there's always the risk of more downside because oil is one of those things when you run out of places to store it, its price can go extremely low, including we saw for a brief period earlier this year, in North Dakota, the price of heavy sour coming out of some of their old wells went below zero. You had to pay to get it hauled away at one point. 50 cents a barrel it cost you. So when nobody wants what you got, oil, of course, always a wanted substance, but we are now at all-time highs in terms of aggregate amount stored. And when we look at the, I think, more important descriptor, which is how many days of oil consumption is now stored above ground, we're approaching levels that were only exceeded once in the early 1930s at the depths of the Great Depression. So lots of oil swimming around in it at this point in time. And so that is not something that makes me super bullish yet. I still want to keep on the sidelines on this one, and even though it feels like it may have turned.
Let's move on then to the precious metals. This is our listener's favorite topic. You talked about the fundamentals, you know, working in our benefit here. We have on both sides of both ponds, central bankers are doing their best to take rates into negative territory. And metals investors love nothing more than when they hear negative interest rates, because generally you have negative real rates of interest. And that tends to coincide statistically better than almost any other scenario with precious metals bull markets. So that's a positive. And then now we have a Fed that's sort of backpedaling on what looked like it could be at least a temporary trend to maybe 2 or 3% on their benchmark overnight lending rate. That now not so much of a big issue. We could see maybe some lower rates ahead instead of much higher rates, as well as, of course, many of the mines now offline that had been rushed into operation over the last 10, 12 years. That limits supply, which is also a plus.
Well, I'll tell you, the central banks are obviously still in danger mode. We just had this morning, we're here on Thursday, about noon, and just earlier this morning, East Coast time, we had the ECB come out and say, hey, we're doing more, right? We're going to do more of this, more of that, and of course, the baton got passed again. I think it went from Japan now to Europe. So Europe's going to do more, and we saw all the predictable things. We saw the euro get clobbered. We saw the dollar spike. We saw gold initially spike down hard on that, doing its usual correlation dance with the dollar, and then something really interesting. Gold has been strong lately. And this is something I love to see, is that initial spike down in gold, which took it from about $12.50 to about $12.37, a good $13 cram down, it just V-turned off of that and went straight back the other way, now standing at about $12.70. That's a pretty big turnaround, and the dollar did fade afterwards, but I love to watch gold move in opposition to the dollar, which it did for a time this morning. It just speaks to the strength gold has from a technical standpoint. We've got a nice cup and handle breakout. We're above all sorts of key moving averages. We're seeing the miners responding. So there's a lot of things bullishly setting up around the price of gold. But it was that piece this morning I love to see when central bankers try one more thing and the market did what it was supposed to do for about 5 or 10 minutes. And then stocks are selling off at this point. Everything sort of reversing. It means that increasingly markets are calling the bluff of the central bankers. You and I and all your listeners know, everybody who's a metal knows that they are the emperors without clothes. I think the markets are starting to say, hey, no clothes. And that's what I'm seeing in the recent action. So yes, negative interest rates, really positive for gold, but not just negative real interest rates. Now we have negative nominal interest rates. You know that old saw people used to throw at me anyway? They'd say, hey, gold, it doesn't pay any interest. And now I get to say, yeah, well, at least it doesn't pay negative interest.
Talked about earlier about the underlying strength of the metal, and I think the initial rally here in the last few weeks off the lows, and we waited for that reaction. Really, everything looked ominous a couple of weeks ago. I mean, we had a huge reaction on the downside, and then something unusual happened. Even with heavily bearish technicals, the market came roaring back. But I'm looking at the weekly picture here. What I'm seeing is internal strength fractally, regardless of the time period observed. And we're starting to see that. We're starting to see surprises on the upside instead of disappointment on the downside. And there's also surprises, let's say, on the upside within the topicality. We heard last week that BlackRock had halted issuing of new shares of its gold ETF, $7.7 billion worth of iShares in their gold trust. And this was due to unexpectedly large demand for its shares. That's music to our ears, to everyone in the gold crowd. Apparently, they claimed they had forgotten to file. To me, it sounds like they were expecting lower prices, and that turnaround that we saw caught them off guard. Another positive sign that even the insiders may be getting caught off guard by the internal strength of the precious metals. Would you like to discuss the mining shares? That's where the real action and excitement has been in 2016.
Well, it certainly has. And of course, what you love to see is some super hated, beaten down asset class, and let's widen it out. This applies as well to miners in general, not just precious metal miners, but we're looking at the copper and other miners like that. The whole commodity sector has just been abused. Last week we saw iron ore rally, if I can use that word, 19% in a single session in the overnights. Some of them I'm looking at and wondering, they look and smell and feel like just simple old routine short covering. But for gold, this is different. And watching the dynamics of how this has come up looks different. And I'm with you. It was back late December, early January. Gold was at like bouncing at that 1,050 mark and having people sending me stuff saying 800 is coming soon, 600, 300, whatever numbers they wanted. 2016 is anything, Chris. This is the most confounding market ever. Everything that people think ought to happen seems to go the other direction. We're in the mother of all tops. These tops take time to play out. I am dead convinced that that gold is just absolutely one of the best ways To be positioned given the fact that what's monetary policy is kind of at the end of its rope. If negative interest rates don't prove that to you, nothing will. And so here we are with gold really starting to put in a rally, and I think it's telling us something.
Firstly, I'd like to start off with the dollar. You know, you touched on this briefly, and the greenback broke, I think, a key support for one of the first times now in almost 2 years. And that on a weekly basis, to me, indicates the rally could fade here over the next, the first component. And that is the threat of a new U.S. equities bear market, and maybe even on a global basis. I haven't read your comments on global equities, but that's now an important component because of this globally interconnected financial economy that we have. The election year phenomenon, where stocks tend to underperform in election years, which has a tendency to put a bid under the precious metals.
The thing that I've been most focused on is, look, this equity advance has been built on probably the weakest economic advance we've seen in a long time. And there were a number of factors fueling this real rise in equities and bonds. Leading off, of course, was the trillions and trillions of central banks printed up. That's ersatz money. It's fake. It's false. It creates the appearance of a boom, if not the reality for a while, but there's always a hangover from that. Secondary to that, we had corporations borrowing and also spending 100% of their income to just buy back their shares. That created another sense of, ooh, look, we're really going places. But when you dig under the data a little bit and you say, where's the underpinnings for the next round of prosperity? What's going to lead to our growth? We're seeing some weakness there. Now, as well, we're, what, 7-6 years into this recovery, and no recovery lasts forever. There's always a recession. So now we're seeing top line, bottom line growth in corporate earnings and revenues falling off. We're seeing global trade falling off. We're seeing all sorts of different commodities pile up. So these, in terms of supply, so taken together, this says, look, we're just entering a weakening cycle here at this point in time. But I think that there's a chance for not just a bear market, but a really spectacularly bad one, because we're entering this one with really weak internal fundamentals, extraordinary amounts of debt on corporate balance sheets. We're seeing it on sovereign balance sheets. We're seeing it all sorts of places, except, thankfully, on households, which in some locations have dialed it back. Not Canada, not Australia. Those two places are going to have deep trouble even on the household side of the balance sheet. But I'm thinking that this could be a real humdinger of a recession, if not a quote-unquote depression.
If we look at the charts, just start off with the charts and we'll steer clear of the fundamentals at first. Statistically, you're looking at charts that are in many ways worse than the year 2000. And what's so ironic is many of these traders today and money managers, hedge fund managers, are super young, super bright hotshots that didn't probably suffer through the late 90s and early 2000s like the rest of us. That's where the hot money is. It's something you can read about, but like so many things in life, you have to experience to, I think, appreciate their magnitude. Funny, because David Morgan on yesterday's show agreed. In fact, he underscored it, that we're seeing many signs, not just echo, but virtually mirror the 2000 bubble peak. I mean, look at some of these price-to-earnings ratios from Amazon, got to be my all-time favorite company, Amazon, Netflix, Tesla, all these fantastic concepts. Price-to-earnings ratios approaching 300, 500 or higher, ultimately unsustainable, with the rare exception of the company that actually meets that price-to-earnings ratio with phenomenal earnings. But all corporations just simply can't do that. It's a non sequitur. You see the recession side of it. That's where I want to throw a wrench into the works. I want to take the opposite side of this for a moment. Look at housing starts. Everybody keeps talking about the end of the world, but this is a fantastic leading indicator. We're not seeing any signs of housing starts rolling over. In fact, they're strong here. And that tends to coincide with solid domestic growth, good GDP numbers.
The housing data is, you know, if you take the bigger chart of it and you really look at where housing was when it was back at its bubble peak in 2006, 2007, 2008, early 2008, stuff like that. What you'll see is that currently, even though we've seen an uptick in housing starts and things like that, it's from a pretty low base. I look at the data, it's fairly noisy. You know, we've had some really, really hot price appreciation in the underlying rental markets in a lot of these places. We're seeing a lot of multifamily housing start activity, of course, as people try and take advantage of those rising rents. But I truly think that rising rent phenomenon is unsustainable. I think it was a trend that happened in large measure for the same reason we saw the shale bubble. Why did that happen? Did it make economic sense? Not really, but That's what you get sometimes when there's a lot of hot free money floating around. You get trends like that. So I'm looking at housing with kind of a squinty sort of a view. It's great in some markets, others I simply don't get. I was coaching people as recently as just 5 or 6 months ago in Calgary, which was in the depths of just being mauled. They were still hanging on to their house, hoping that they could, wouldn't have to reduce the price and all of this. It's just looking at what's happening with the oil market up there. And, my counsel was take whatever price you can get and don't look back. And of course, I think they might have appreciated, taking that advice now, because now it's completely obvious that housing indeed finally followed the economy. So in some cases, I got to tell you, I think housing's not your leading indicator.
Or perhaps a coincidental indicator. To 2006, I think we first started pounding the table week after week after week. I'll never forget it. Housing on a national basis, the Case-Shiller index was off just shy of 0.5%. And as it approached 1% to 2%, I remember CNBC, so many top outlets pounding the table. This is the time to buy. What an incredible opportunity. Housing has never been off on an annual basis in 75 years. The mantra, the mindset was so established. No way. We have this massive inventory. You have subprime debt and the Alt-A debt, and then the debt really gets scary after that. And it's a mountain headed this way. We won't be cleared out through 2012. And 2012 was the exact bottom. But I am with you. We are overdue for a correction. We're overdue for a recession. Why don't I give you the floor? Tell listeners any other topics you'd like to cover today.
So peakprosperity.com, that's the site. And, what we do every year, once a year, is we have a seminar that we hold. And this year we've added a whole extra day to it. Usually it's just a weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. This time it starts on Thursday. That's going to be in Roe, Massachusetts, and it's almost full. We have a lot of interest this time. The furthest person coming, apparently, according to our schedule here, is coming from Singapore. We have people coming from various other countries all across the United States. That's April 14th to the 17th. You can find out about it right there at our website in the blog area. And so that's really captivating us. We love holding this seminar. We get a bunch of people together who understand really where the world is, where it's going, and like to be around other people who understand it. And it's always a little bit of a party, because all these professional, successful individuals get together and go, oh, you think this way too, huh? Great. And I think particularly in this election year, there's extra sense, social pressure, or whatever you want to call it, a social sense in the air that change is coming. And that's really what we talk about, is how to manage that change, not just from a physical standpoint, but from an emotional and a health standpoint. Those are equally important.
Very good. And, as we wrap up, Adam Taggart sent over a copy of the book you two penned. And I think I mentioned to him in a conversation the other day how I keep it with my reading material in our reading chair here. We cover economics. That's the main thing. But it's always good to have a little diversification, or, a little more balance, let's call it, in the discussions. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about your tome there is this homesteading idea. And I know that not everyone listening to our voice today, including my family, have the ability to do this, but it pushes you in the right direction when you start to think sustainably. Tell people more about that interesting water heater concept. Wasn't terribly expensive. I believe it's more of a passive water heating, where you have a thermal mass on the roof, and that, of course, collects the solar radiation, and as those rays, of course, convert from a solar energy over long periods of time, maybe 10, 15, 20 years, to recoup that initial investment. And it also gives you more autonomy from the grid, if you will. Tell us more, please.
It's an example of something that we talk about in terms of material capital. It's in the book Prosper that you just mentioned. And so under material capital, this is an investment we can make. And investing usually means I send my money to Wall Street, hope for the best, right? On my roof, I have an investment. And it's just nothing fancy. It's these boxes that are black, and inside those boxes are pipes. And in those pipes is a liquid that circulates. And that liquid circulates down into my basement, where it runs through a couple of hot water tanks. And I have at any point in time in my basement about 260 gallons of piping hot water. And the total cost to run that system now is a little tiny circulating pump, that's it, and it uses about the same energy as a 100-watt light bulb, and it doesn't run all the time just when the sun's out. So for about 6 hours a day, I have a 100-watt light bulb turned on, and that gives me 260 gallons of 165-degree water. So it's just one of the most phenomenally wonderful things that works fantastically, and I live in Massachusetts, not the sun capital of the world. Works great here. you live anywhere else with more sun, it works even better.
6 o'clock in the morning. There hasn't been any sun, doctor, for almost 12 hours in the dead of winter. How warm are those showers at 6 in the morning?
That amount of hot water will carry me through about 7 days of cloudiness, and sometimes we get to more than that, and then my oil furnace kicks on and tops it off. So it's still integrated with my existing hot water system, but that rarely turns on anymore. Yeah, that's how that works.
So think of that. I mean, think of the savings. A water heater can consume a tremendous amount of natural gas, okay, or propane or whatever is in the particular area that folks live in, plus delivery disruption, propane throughout the winter, which can cause all kinds of havoc, especially in a mountainous area as we live in here. Sometimes the propane trucks can't even make deliveries for many weeks at a time due to negative weather conditions, just when we need it the most. So that can also be an issue. And again, you only need one solar panel and maybe one golf cart battery to maintain the 100 watt or so pump there. That's probably pumping something like antifreeze would be my guess, or some derivative through the system. What a neat idea. Maybe over the next, you know, interviews, we can address some of the other fantastic ideas, such as your sustainable gardening. You're going to save a lot of people back trouble. I don't think we probably have time for that today. Dr. Chris Martinson, Peak Prosperity. You have to get a copy of Prosper.
Thank you. It would be a real pleasure.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned, with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources, containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Yeah. Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. I recently caught a local talk radio interview while traveling in the Midwest about the immediate and severe economic impact that would occur throughout the Midwest and the nation if the largest of the Sioux locks was disrupted for an extended period of time. The Sioux locks in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, connect Lake Superior to the lower Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway. The largest of the Sioux locks is the Po, which is 47 years old. 70% of U.S. flag-carrying vessels are Po-class vessels, according to a news release on the Great Lakes Maritime Task Force website. A lengthy closure of the Po would slow trade to a trickle at best. In fact, what caught my attention in the local talk radio interview on this subject was the discussion about how dependent Midwestern manufacturing is on the free flow of raw materials on the Great Lakes. That free flow has a supply chain that ultimately impacts the entire country. It was suggested that a shutdown of the Sioux locks for an extended period, due to mechanical failure or otherwise, could catapult unemployment into the high teens and low 20% range in a month or two for states like Michigan and Ohio. The national unemployment rate could exceed 11%. Gross domestic product could drop up to 6%, which, when averaged against any rate of expansion, could put the annualized GDP decrease as low as minus 4%. These are potential scenarios based on aging infrastructure. Last summer, emergency repairs closed another of the Sioux locks, the 73-year-old MacArthur Lock, which is the smaller of the two functional locks at the Sioux, for a period of 20 days. Nearly 2 million tons of various cargoes were delayed, but had the Po suffered a similar outage, the delays and cascading ramifications would have been much greater. A report put out by the Department of Homeland Security in October of 2015 and referenced in several online articles on this subject is titled "The Perils of Efficiency: An Analysis of an Unexpected Closure of the Po Lock and Its Impact." It contained an executive summary that stated, "One of the nation's most economically vital systems, the iron mining, integrated steel production, manufacturing supply chain, is also potentially the least resilient. A disruption of the Po lock likely will cause an almost complete shutdown of Great Lakes steel production. A shutdown of Great Lakes steel production likely will cause almost all North American appliances, automobile, construction equipment, farm equipment, mining equipment, and rail car production to cease within weeks. The disruption would likely result in widespread bankruptcies and dislocations throughout the economy. Almost 11 million people would likely be unemployed because of the impact, and the North American economies would likely enter a severe recession. Fixing this has apparently been a priority for some time. A second Po-sized lock to provide redundancy at the Sioux has twice been authorized by Congress. The second time in 2007 at full federal expense. However, funds for its construction have not been appropriated because of a flawed analysis of the project's cost-benefit ratio. The Army Corps of Engineers recently received $1.35 million to redo an economic study on twinning the Poe Lock, which will replace a 2005 cost-benefit analysis that rendered the project ineligible under federal budgeting because it showed every dollar spent would only return 73 cents in benefit. Aging infrastructure is a significant issue that will be addressed either by prudent planning or crisis management. The crash of 2008 and 2009 had not yet occurred when this project had been approved for a second time in 2007. Now, because of indecision, a trigger point for a potential repeat of the economic crisis looms in northern Michigan. Jim Rickards has referred to the snowflake and the avalanche. This scenario contains both elements. An aging Sioux Lock, the snowflake, and a financial avalanche, the repercussions, if the crisis occurs. Aging infrastructure is going to be of growing concern to Western economies moving forward. There will be two ways to address it: prudent planning or crisis management. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.